This is March 12th, 2017. And since we went on daylight savings time early this morning, people who may have planned to hear this live streaming may be missing it if you forgot to set your clocks ahead. But the rest of us are here. And I want to talk today about death and dying. As I'm sure most of you know, since we sent a notice out, last Monday night, one of our residents here had an overdose. He died. And we've been doing the memorial prayer on an almost daily basis. We didn't do it yesterday because it was so full with the workshop business. But it's something I've never done in 30 years of teaching now. I've never really talked about, well, in particular, I haven't talked about the memorial prayer. Our fifth memorial service will be at 11 o'clock this morning, and we'll probably have some people here who haven't been to it yet and are coming in later, non-members of the center. His parents might come. My mind has just been so much on this business of death and dying and the memorial prayer that I felt I couldn't do anything else except this something on this topic. So everything about death and dying and rebirth is in Buddhism, and I include Zen in that. You don't have to be a Buddhist to practice Zen, but for those of us who consider ourselves Zen Buddhists, everything is based on rebirth, which to me, and perhaps to some others of you, seems the most natural thing in the world, that death is not an ending and birth is not a beginning. What is there that we know of in life or in reality that comes to a stop completely? What is there in which the energy dies, period, done, and doesn't continue in some other form? So it seems that, to me, as a lifelong Buddhist, that it would be the burden of those who don't believe in rebirth to come up with reasons why they don't. Historically, the Chinese and the Indians, Asian Indians, just took rebirth for granted, and so did some other countries. But even just those two giant countries, China and India, would mean that about very roughly half of the world's population takes it for granted. Of course we're reborn. So that is behind everything that I'm going to be saying this morning and reading from, is just the basic premise of rebirth. In Buddhist texts, we have this pairing of words, birth and death. And I think that's not natural. It's not part of our own culture to pair. We would more likely pair death with life and death. But in the Buddhist text, it's birth and death. The idea being that we have this, we're in this endless round of existence, of being born, living, declining, and dying, and then being reborn again and again and again and again. And the implication is that this is just one round after another of suffering. Maybe it's because of these traditional countries, the prevalence of suffering, the obviousness of suffering in traditional countries, that this wouldn't this would also be just accepted as a just a condition of life, suffering. I think we as Americans aren't as likely to accept that. We have found ways that I would suggest no culture, no people in throughout history, we have found more ways to relieve suffering or to avoid suffering that, well, just speaking for myself, I couldn't quite relate to that when I first got into Zen practice. It sounds so dreary and gloomy. Life is suffering. And for those of us who are fortunate enough, it isn't very, we don't run up against it very often, except in a small ways. Of course, the truth is, we all suffer in some slight way, some subtle way, day in and day out, but we don't think of it so much as suffering. It's another way to understand it is, so the word suffering is the usual translation for dukkha. This is the first of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths. So life is dukkha. Dukkha, if suffering is too hard for you to relate to, then consider it another legitimate translation of it is it's frustration. Who doesn't get frustrated every day in one way or another, if in traffic or with one's partner or at work? Frustration, anxiety is another way to understand the pervasiveness of suffering. Just ordinary daily anxiety. The forms, different forms of anxiety, which we talked about last week. So, if we consider, from a Buddhist point of view, that we're on this wheel of, let's make it, frustration, anxiety, loss. How about loss? That's another one. Who escapes some kind of loss in their life? Not just the obvious losing people close to you, but losing in things that you're trying to achieve or that you have achieved, suffering loss, losing a job, losing a pet. This is what we're up against as far as nearly endless course of existence. So birth and death. We're going to get to the actual memorial prayer just a little later, but just a few things more about so-called, what we call death. There have been a lot of cool analogies that people have come up with in the Buddhist tradition. Birth as the appearance of clouds in the sky. And death is their breaking up and scattering in all directions. So although a cloudy sky and a clear sky can be described as different conditions, the sky itself is unaffected. That analogy is mentioned in Roshi Kaplow's The Zen of Living and Dying, which, by the way, I think never got the full attention it deserved. Roshi Kaplow was right there with this matter of birth and death, life and death, and in his later years he really made an exhaustive study of it. I mean, not to mention his experiential study of it through his Zen career, but then reading things and then coming up with this superb, comprehensive book about living and dying. And it's not just Buddhist. He wanted to fold into it the understanding of death and dying and rebirth. Well, rebirth is more a Buddhist thing, but death and dying from other traditions, Judaism, Christianity, even Islam. So if you have an interest in not dodging the subject of death and dying, then and learning more about it from as a kind of overview of world wisdom, then you could do no better than reading his The Zen of Living and Dying. One way to understand the teaching of rebirth is that it really means reconception. That life begins with conception. That it doesn't follow from that that we shouldn't allow women to make choices about abortion. I reject that. It can't be denied that life begins at conception, not just at birth. So what is it that's reborn then? This is the $64,000 question that many people have asked. If there's no soul as part of Buddhist or Zen doctrine, if there's no soul, and no, which means no self, then what is it that is reborn? And there, here, it's just difficult to talk about. The idea is that this here is all based on karma. Karma literally means action and reaction. Same thing, really. If you have action, then you have reaction. And the idea is that everything we do throughout our life, raising our arm, walking around the block, everything we do, everything we say to others, and even everything we think is creating a pattern or patterns in our consciousness. The more times we repeat these things, the words or the actions or the thoughts, the more times we repeat them, the deeper a groove is formed in the mind, or the more force or momentum, the more deeply ingrained becomes this habit force. I still think that's, if among all the possible ways of talking about karma, habit force or habit energy is maybe the best. So this puts great importance on how we conduct our lives, of course. How we act, not just with big decisions, but how we act moment by moment, how we speak to other people, and how we think. Think because our words and our actions arise to a great extent. They arise out of our thought patterns. And this then points to the enormous importance of working with the mind on a daily basis. How indispensable it is to have some kind of meditation. It doesn't have to be Zen. Some kind of meditation to work with these habit forces of the mind, in particular the reactive habit forces, because this is what gets us into trouble, the way we react to people and circumstances and conditions in an unskillful way. And so we have this physical training called practice. that we can do every day at home or here to reform our karma, our habit forces, reshape ourselves. That's what we are. It's what the I and the we are is habit energy. And so when we lose the body, when the body dies, this habit energy doesn't. It continues on just through sheer momentum, through force of habit. This habit energy continues on as a kind of psychic energy. It continues to reverberate, especially in the first, they say, in the first 3 days after death, as a form of consciousness that is admittedly very difficult to talk about. But it does involve a relinquishment of control, or the illusion of control. Once we have clinically died, there we come on this consciousness or mental energy or habit force becomes unmoored from the body. And when we ever say the body, we mean the body-mind. You can't really tease apart body and mind. Mind that is small m mind, the mind of our cognitive processes, our the intellect, our discursive mind, the mind that analyzes and thinks and categorizes and classifies, the human intellect, the distinctly human intellect. This mind and the body are so interwoven and intimately connected. Roshi Kapila used to say, mind is just the immaterial aspect of body, and body is the material aspect of mind, the two sides of one coin. So in this Taisho, whenever I say body, I mean the body-mind, or the mind-body, which we can distinguish from our true mind, capital M mind, our true nature. So at death, there is a detachment, there is an unmooring from the body-mind, and that means a relinquishment of any sense of willful control over the processes that follow. And this leaves us in a state of vulnerability. Of course, because we are at that point, once we enter the transition from death, the transition from death to rebirth, there is that transition the Tibetans call the bardo. Sometimes it's called the bardo of becoming. Bardo is a good word, simple word, unlike every other Tibetan word I've ever heard of. It's easy to pronounce. So we'll use bardo. I'm sure that they have their own word in Japan and China, but I don't know what it is. So we enter this bardo, and then we come face to face with our karma. There's that word again. We come face to face with all of the mental processes and mental physical processes that we no longer have control over, that confront us just out of habit. Now, if this all sounds way too exotic and hard to believe, come to Sesshin sometime. Sesshin, especially a seven-day Sesshin, is truly a dry run for the bardo. The conditions of Sesshin are so stripped away and so simplified. It's almost entirely in silence. I mean, students can come and talk with me up to, two or three times a day. But other than that, Sesshin is in complete silence. And in that silence, and in the sitting, the 10, for some people, 12, 14, 16 hours of sitting a day, we sink into this detachment from the body-mind to one degree or another. Some people will be unable at first to let go of their mental processes. They keep playing with their thoughts and daydreaming. But as time goes on, that gets harder to do when you're sitting in silence all that time every day and into the night. The mind as we know it becomes silenced. It gets quieter. And in that silence, then we experience our karma. We experience the habit force of the mind. And that means the images that images may come up, thoughts, memories. There was this book that was widely known in the 1960s, The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who won, I think, a Pulitzer Prize or Nobel Prize. In it, Gulag is these slave labor camps that Stalin and maybe a successor of his set up in Siberia. These prisons, these remote prisons in terrible cold, there were those who survived them, and those who did survive them said that it was not the imprisonment itself that was so frightening, but the recollection of the life they had led prior to their arrest. And for some people, this also is the most painful part of a sesshin, or any extended sitting. It doesn't have to be a seven-day sesshin. It can be a shorter one. It can also be just sitting on your own at home for an hour. It's much less likely that you'll get a taste of the bardo when you're sitting at home alone. Because it doesn't give you enough time to really relinquish this mind of thinking and so forth. But people talk about the pain of sesshin. I think they usually or the pain they're afraid of in sesshin when they haven't gone yet. The physical pain, it can be bad enough, but the mental pain, the memories, for me, that's what haunted me when I was new, my early sesshins, is just the memories, the things that came up of the careless ways I had talked to people, the insensitive ways I had, things I had said to people. It's really kind of a haunting. It can be. I don't know. I've learned that not everyone is so. Not everyone has memories come up that can haunt them like that. For some people, they find a way to flee into the future. Thoughts of planning and worrying about what's going to happen in the future. But for me, it was always memories, which is one of the transforming things about Sesshin is to have this clear, sobering look at the ways we misuse our speech and our thoughts and our actions, because then it can help change us. It's Henry David Thoreau says to regret deeply is to live afresh. These survivors of the Gulag and survivors of other concentration camps, and they got another chance in those terrible conditions of oppression and loneliness, and they could see into how they had misused their opportunity as human beings, and then when released, did have the chance to make it right. I think that's one of the reasons why the A Christmas Carol, the story of Ebenezer Scrooge, why it is such a classic, because it lays out in a very dramatic, colorful way the transformation of this miser that happens as a result of his being led into, let's call it, the bardo, where he's exposed to these scenes of himself, his own mistreatment of people, and also his earlier life as a child. That comes up too in Sesshin, if you go to enough of them. And the joy of when he is given another chance, he comes back, the ghosts release him, and he comes back and he has a chance to get things right. In Sesshin, we have our own ghosts that we face. Now, I'm starting to worry that I'm casting Sesshin as this dreadful dreadful experience. Let's call it a trying experience. It tests us, but many, 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 many people keep going back for more because there's something that compensates for the emotional and physical pain. There's something that I can't imagine finding anywhere else except in these conditions. Because Sesshin is not, the way it's different from a bardo is that you know there's going to be an end to it, and you have the teacher, at least, to talk with, someone to guide you through these states of mind, these worlds, these realms of existence that we encounter in the course of a Sesshin. You have someone there, whether you know it or not, it's your best friend, it's your closest ally, who is devoted to helping you through these things. Not so, I guess, with the bardo. Well, you do. You have your true nature. That's the ultimate friend and guide. But Sesshin gives us practice at seeing images and memories and thoughts, and the thoughts we know can be very painful, thoughts of self-recrimination, thoughts of doubt, thoughts of hatred, self-hatred. We have practice at seeing that all those thoughts and all those images and all those emotional states pass. They are all just passing states, weather systems moving through the mind. This is why we're so strict about people following through with their commitment to however long they're committed to Sesshin. If they're committed to 7 days, you don't leave during Sesshin, before those 7 days are up. Or if it may be 4 days of the Sesshin or 2 days or whatever, we allow that now for people to go to part of Sesshin. But whatever you're committed to, you gotta stick it out to see that these things, these painful things, pass. That is the ultimate lesson in life, that things pass. Patrick, before he overdosed last Monday, he went through a 7-day Sesshin. And he had his trying moments, everyone does, but he had the fiber, which really means, never mind courage and all, what it comes down to is faith. He had the faith to hang in there. And he emerged from those 7 days renewed. As anyone is who makes it through. And then he came back to the next one he could, a 2-day. And then, let me just say, it was such a shock to all of us. Terrible, of course, terrible blow. With anything, there are multiple causes. Really, just anything. Everything that happens in life, every event, every occurrence, has more than one cause. It has usually a combination of different causes and conditions. Patrick was vulnerable from the beginning because he had been through rehab and then relapsed and rehab and relapsed. So we knew the risk. But he had been doing so well on here in training. But what may have been the conclusive turn was that he got a big check from the IRS as his tax refund. Until then, he'd had nothing. He was penniless, so he had no opportunity to relapse. But with this suddenly coming into this money, and then finding himself, he took 3 days of time off, even as a quite new resident. He'd just been here since December. Even as a new resident, he got 3 days of time off, and suddenly he was flung into 3 days of no structure. All right, I'm going to turn now to the memorial prayer. When you lose someone close to you, if you can find any inspiration, any solace from the memorial prayer, that would be my urging, is to do that, even on your own, to do it for that parent or sibling or friend or child, to do it even on your own. There are a lot of so-called Zen temples in Japan that support themselves through the donations of doing memorial prayers and funerals. It's very lucrative in Japan. That's enough for them to get by and keep the temple in repair. The Japanese are enormously generous in donating for these services. Personally, I question the value of doing a memorial prayer for someone who nobody knows. I think it's worth doing. It's better than nothing. But for those doing the, the memorial service, memorial prayer is just part of the service. But doing memorial services for someone you've never met, really. So when my father died, and then my mother, and then my sister, I didn't ask the center to do memorial services because it seemed, and this is just me maybe, I'm not saying other people shouldn't have the center do these, but for me it just seemed like a pretty empty kind of thing. All these people who might come, they feel obliged to come because it's my family, who've never met them. But what I absolutely did was do this memorial prayer on my own. First the service, and then each day the prayer itself. And this is why, because even if you don't particularly thoroughly buy into the helping the deceased, even if that's a stretch that you can't quite swallow, what I found was it helped me. It helped me to do this. It helps with the grieving process, because you're doing something. You're offering. You're giving. You're reaching out. You're active. You're calling out to the person and to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and it's so valuable. So I just did it either at home or here at the center on my own, and I think it's just the best thing you can possibly do, even just for yourself. But it starts. Now, the prayer, we don't have time to go over the chants that precede the memorial prayer. These are our standard ones, four of our standard chants, very important chants. I don't mean to minimize them at all. The Prajnaparamita is the most widely chanted sutra in the world, Buddhist countries all over the world, the Prajnaparamita, the Heart Sutra, the core of which is form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. You can see how important this is as part of the memorial service, because the deceased is being confronted by mental formations, thought forms. And the whole importance is to see these as just ephemeral phenomena that come and go, and to see through them. And then there are the other ones, the Kanon-gyo, of course, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, and both Dharanis, the Shosaimyo Dharani is a Dharani for averting disaster. You can see why that would be part of a memorial service. And then the Dai Shin, that's the long Dharani. But to get to the memorial prayer, it begins, O Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Now, what we're doing is we are in a memorial prayer, we are calling out to the deceased. Again, this would be hard for some people to grasp, but calling up to the deceased to remind the deceased of these timeless truths in the various chants and in this, but we're also invoking the help of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Now, what does that mean? It may mean something different in other kinds of Buddhism, where the Buddha is seen as a godlike figure. But in Zen, when we're calling out to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas were really calling out to our own Buddha nature and our own Bodhisattva nature. Bodhisattva means, just very quickly, it's an embodiment of compassion. So in Zen, we come to understand that nothing is outside our own mind. Everything is our own mind. There's nothing outside it. There aren't Buddhas, awakened ones, outside us, and there aren't Bodhisattvas outside us. These are dimensions of our own mind, our features of our own consciousness. In the case of Buddhas, it's that which is awake in us. Somewhere in us there is this wakefulness, this awareness of the way things are. And Bodhisattvas is our innate response to those who are in need of help. So, O Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, we're saying, okay, that in us which is wakeful, that in us which is compassionate, come on, wake up, pay attention. This is where we have a chance to make a difference for someone. O Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, abiding in all directions. I'm reminded of this passage that we do in our standard chanting service, where together we place the hands palm to palm. We say, faith in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha brings true liberation. No, 10 directions, 3 worlds, all Buddhas, Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas. What we're saying when we say that, which many people here have done thousands of times, we're really saying everywhere, in all the directions, up, down, north, south, east, west, all the in between, everywhere, without limit, there are this Buddha mind, this Buddha energy and Bodhisattva energy. It's the pervasiveness, the unlimited nature of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, endowed with great compassion, endowed with love. We're reminding ourselves of the tremendous potential that we ourselves have, affording protection to sentient beings. Protection, because the deceased in the bardo is in this vulnerable state, unmoored from the body-mind processes, the defensive structure of the mind. This means a vulnerable state. It's like the self has the very tenuous nature to it. It's like a child, a young child. It's still developing a sense of self and other, which it needs to do. We all need to do that as children. And yet it's not there yet, and so children are vulnerable. They're open. They're wide open. And this is our condition as we're passing through the bardo. And then we're still addressing ourselves, consent through the kindness of your great compassion to come forth. O compassionate ones, we repeat this 3 more times, again to remind ourselves, O compassionate ones, you possess the wisdom of understanding, the love of compassion, the power of doing divine deeds and of protecting an incomprehensible measure. Incomprehensible just means beyond the reach of thought. This help, this aid that we are directing to the deceased is not something that we can grasp with our ordinary mind. And then the name of the deceased, in this case, today, Patrick Mullen is passing from this world to the next. He is taking a great leap. The light of this world has faded for him. these next few sentences could also, we could say this at the beginning. I've actually considered in my opening talk of the seven-day session, citing these lines. We are all taking a great leap as we enter this seven-day session. The light of the world as we know it, our connection with the world, with our loved ones, as at home, is faded. We have entered solitude with our karmic forces. He has gone into a vast silence. He is borne away by the great ocean of birth and death. Great ocean of birth and death. In the only book I know of in English by Yasutani Roshi, Roshi Kappo's main teacher in Japan, his primary teacher in Japan, he compares, and this is, I'm sure, not originating with him, this is probably an old analogy in Buddhism, that our life is like a wave in the ocean. I'm reading here from it. The book is called Eight Bases of Belief in Buddhism. A wave rises when the energy of the wind passes through the water. That wave, in turn, by its energy, produces the next wave. If there is no resistance or friction, this wave action continues endlessly. Suppose that here and now we have sufficient energy to create one human being. His life energy will produce the next life, just as the energy of one wave produces the next wave. This energy will never disappear, resulting in a continuous formation of successive lives. Now, in the case of a wave, the movement of the water is vertical. The water itself does not ripple or move horizontally. He's talking not those waves that crash in at the shore, but out there in the rest of the ocean. The only thing which moves horizontally is the energy. Not knowing this fact, most people think that a wave is the movement of one specific area of the water. Similarly, they think that there is some fixed substance which may be called the I in a human being. Capital I. I think, one of a number of good analogies for this matter of continuous life and death. One wave bobs up, the energy passes through it, and then it settles again, and the next wave comes up. This line, he has entered solitude with his karmic forces. Again, the more times we enter the solitude of Sesshin with our karmic forces, the more skillful we become, the deeper becomes our faith in the transitory nature of all of these things. And the insubstantial, transitory means insubstantial. These things, these mind states and emotional states and physical states, physical pain, these have no substance to them and they have no roots to them. They pass. Everything passes. And everyone can accept that. Yes, we know that intellectually, everything passes, duh. But to live through it, to live through these states, and we begin by taking them as so real. Oh, now what? Oh, great. Here I am. Pain without end. This is day two. For God's sake, what is going to be the next 5 days or any all of the crazy talk we have to ourselves? Well, it passes. If it doesn't completely pass, at least our relationship to the pain changes. Our relationship changes and it recedes over time. If we're making a halfway earnest effort to stay with our breath or whatever our practice is, it will change. The nature of the pain will change, as will the other kinds of pain. This memorial prayer that we use, which I think is very good, it's not as long as the original one that we find in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's a good adaptation, but the one in the Tibetan Book of the Dead is more foreboding. These are the lines of one translation. He's entered a great wilderness. He's driven on by the wind of karma. He's going where there is no solid ground. And then the next stanza, again, O compassionate ones, protect Patrick, who is defenseless. Be to him like a father and a mother. Oneself. O compassionate ones, let not the force of your compassion be weak, but aid him. Let him not go into miserable states of existence. This miserable states of existence, really, one translation of this prayer is, let him not go into the three lower realms. These are the lowest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. The three lowest realms are realms of the hellish realms, realms of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits, and then the third one is going up now. The third one is the realm of animals. I find it most useful to think of these six realms as psychological states, although I may find when I get into the Bardo that they're not just psychological states. And then finally, forget not your ancient vows. And just reminding us to, just like the line, consent through your great compassion to come forth. It's okay, pay attention. Open your heart. Attend to this. Don't be daydreaming as you're doing it. And that's the end of the memorial prayer and the end of our Teisho. So we'll now recite the four vows. Beings without number,
I bow to the great endless line patterned by vows of uproot, dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to the chain, all beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gains beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the rich way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gains beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.